Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 7th, 2005. Today's session is How Many Shoes? Asceticism and Consumerism, presented by Larry Rasmussen.
Indeed, all of earthly creation, as we used a visual meditation on Psalm 104 for that. Now that was, I thought, so effectively captured by a soul purpose last night in the Vespers with the musical praying. Let us praise God, Aaron. What was the one? The musical refrain that we had each
time. That web of beauty? Yeah. Praise to God who is
fun. Praise to God. with then the names of the birds in Washington State, though they didn't know those were our names for them, and they didn't much care about Washington State, except as home and habitat, they're not real worried about who's governor and who's not governor. and then we had the names of the plants the next time around, whose relationship to Washington is also one of home and habitat, and then the names of all of the villagers, and all of these together and individually are sacraments. their words of God. And in that sense, which is the most basic sense of all, we're all standing on holy ground. We cannot be anywhere else. We literally cannot be anywhere else. We're all Adam, earth creature, Adam from Adama, topsoil. We don't live on earth so much as we live in earth as earth. From topsoil you came, and to topsoil you'll return. So speaks the author of Genesis, and so speaks the psalmist. Next, we looked at Moses unlacing his Birkenstocks amidst many bushes burning with the mysterious presence of the great I Am. And I tried to pose the question of whether we do have or even can have a sense of holy ground if we should change the text to read, Moses, Moses, take off your Air Nikes. You're standing on holy real estate. What happens to our sense of holy ground, of which we are a precious part, if all things are a collection of objects to us as market commodities, rather than all things as a communion of subjects in a common community of life? Then we finished very abruptly with a description from 1848 of the globalizing economy. It was a description of capitalism as a rising force that would scramble and sometimes dissolve completely all feudal, national, and religious identities and give rise to a global civilization governed by market imperatives. Quote, all fixed, flat, frozen relations all fixed frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new formed relations become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profane. When Thomas Friedman, in his new book, which I strongly recommend to you, The World is Flat, came across that passage from 1848, he was stunned that it accurately described to a T what has happened since the fall of the Berlin Wall. He only differs from the 1848 authors at one point. He thinks they are profoundly wrong. That capitalism would, this is their judgment, in response to the great inequalities that it generates in the production of unprecedented wealth, ignite a global revolution to end oppression. He thought capitalism would do that and thus sow the seeds of its own destruction. And Friedman is right. The masses cannot resist its lure, whatever its exploitation and injustice. Tonight's session is How Many Shoes? Remember our summer theme, take off your shoes, you're standing on holy ground. How many shoes, asceticism and consumerism? And I want to continue our description of the tensions of global capitalism and holy ground. I'm serious about the question of how we stand on holy ground, given the most powerful human construct to date, namely the global economy. So we're first going to describe the economy of capitalism, but as an economy of consumerism. We can do it several ways. That's the one that I'm choosing. I have all my notes here on my Dell Inspiron 8600 laptop. Tom Witt reminded me that last night when I was showing this beautiful visual meditation on Psalm 104, before we hit, George hit the button there, we had the Microsoft logo rotating around on the screen. So
that's made in China.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's a global supply line, yeah. Part of which is China. I'm also sitting here in my Air Nikes, which are made all over the place. Then we're going to turn to asceticism, the economy of asceticism, as an ancient cross-cultural set of Christian traditions, as well as a deep tradition in many other faiths, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, and so on. Now, my objective is to accurately describe these economies. I want the discussion to be what we do with the from the description, but I also know that every person has an angle, set of experiences, a perspective on this. So you jump right in when you have something to modify, nuance, challenge, or rebut in my description. First, we're going to start with an economy of consumerism. Now, we've got to collect some hard data. So I put a pencil and a paper in your seat. And I want you to write three numbers on this piece of paper. We got to know what we're talking about here. I put two formulas on the board. A divided by B equals X and E equals MC squared. We're going to focus on the first one. What is A? A, write the number of shoes you own. Not the number of pairs of shoes you own. A number of shoes that you own.
Sandals.
Sandals, everything that shods your feet. That includes, you know, flip-flops. Write down the number of shoes, foot apparel that you own. Come on, folks, write a number down there. You're going through your closet.
It's soul work.
Soul work, yes. This is soul work. Gives another meaning to the word soul purpose here, too.
Do we count the ones we don't use?
Oh, yeah, the number of shoes you own. It's not a hard question. I'm afraid you'll have to estimate in some cases, yeah. If you don't know exactly how many shoes you own, then give us a good estimate. You know, I don't think Moses would have had this kind of trouble. What's with the balcony? You got no pencils and papers?
We're together. This is only A, yeah.
So that's your first number on there. Everybody got a number down. Second number.
B?
Write the number of feet you have.
Can we estimate?
Yeah, you can estimate. So this has got to be hard data. It's important to get the exact number of shoes and then number of feet. Okay, third. Divide the number of feet you have into the number of shoes you own. A divided by B. All right? Equals, and then write down that number. This will give you the total number of shoes per square foot. All right, now we've got to find out how many there are shoes that are owned in this row.
Oh, no.
So I want to ask if the people on the ends of the rows would mind tallying. So the front row, pass yours all the way around here. Would you mind tallying? All right. Second row, pass it this way. And would you mind tallying? Third row, pass it to your elected board. And maybe you can just like to get back here.
Nobody wants to choose it here.
No, no.
Could this be anonymous?
Yeah, this is anonymous. You don't need to put your name. The last number should be the shoes.
I don't know.
Somebody over there.
All right. Now, this is a history of consumerism. And I made it easy for you. What we should really know is the number of shoes you've owned in your lifetime.
You didn't say that.
No, I didn't say, I didn't ask for that. I'm just saying that if we did this right, as a history of consumerism, we should just not know the present. We should know the number of shoes you've owned in your lifetime. Then, when we had that hard data, we would compare the total number of sandals that Moses wore, we could find that out, and including those that he shed on the mountain of God. I think his number would come much closer to the number for millions, even billions of people today, than our number. At least most of the people, not necessarily all, in this room, if you are a card-carrying member of the consumerist culture and economy, like I am. Okay, here are the other data on the economy as a stream, the economy of consumerism as a stream of the global economy. I'm going to just focus on the last 50 years of economic compulsion as a way of life. But first this, and it's very important. The great achievement of capitalism is to have solved the ancient and seemingly intractable problem of all economy, namely the problem of production. No kind of human economy has even begun to match capitalism's capacity to generate material wealth. It was the first economy to raise the masses of people from their misery. none has lifted masses of people from the compulsions of survival, of subsistence and survival, and offered them freedom to pursue other noble ventures beyond that of attaining their daily bread. That's an extraordinary achievement. It remains the great lure for those who do face the compulsions of survival on economies that don't produce in the way capitalism does. I mean, you could put it in simple terms, words of Billie Holiday, I think it was Billie Holiday, "I've been rich and I've been poor, rich is better." Now, with that as background, let's go to the story of the last half century. On a planetary scale here, the 20th century, well, yeah, let's take the whole 20th century to start with, and I'll go to 1950. 20th century saw the economy expand 14-fold, energy use expanded 16-fold, industrial output 40-fold, carbon dioxide emissions 13-fold, and the use of water 8-fold. 10 times more energy was used in the 20th century than in the previous 1,000 years. More tons of topsoil were lost in the 20th century than were formed in the previous 1,000 years. And more rocks and soil were moved by human beings in the 20th century than by glaciers, volcanoes, and tectonic plates. According to Alan Turing, global consumer classes produced and consumed as many goods and services in the half century from 1950 to 2000 as were produced and consumed throughout the entire period of history up to that date. We're talking about massive economic activity, and if you follow Friedman and others, you ain't seen nothing yet. When China, India, Eastern Europe, Russia come on board, as they are coming on board, in ways that challenge and parallel the United States, Western Europe, Taiwan, Singapore, this curve goes even more dramatically upward. Now, beginning around 1950 in the United States, consumerism was explicitly promoted as a healthy way of life redounding to the common good. The customer is the responsible contributing citizen in a consumer's republic who, by way of the overflow of affluence, would further democracy and equality. That's what comes up after the war. A 1947 photo essay in Life magazine entitled "Family Status Must Improve, It Should Buy More for Itself to Better the Living of Others" spread the before and after pictures across its pages. Before, working class families in modest surroundings became, after, middle class suburbanites in ranch style homes, a big yard, and appliance rich Christians. Life had illustrated what a contemporary 20th century fund, it's a group, a study had commended, and I'm quoting the 20th century fund. To achieve a healthy and a health and decency standard for everyone by 1960, each U.S. family should acquire, in addition to a pleasant roof over its head, a vacuum cleaner, washing machine, stove, electric refrigerator, telephone, electric toaster, and such miscellaneous household supplies as matching dishes, silverware, cooking utensils, tools, cleaning materials, stationery, and postage stamps. This is a recommendation. Both Life and the 20th Century Fund mirrored this post-World War II consensus that expanding economic pies will further the general good of the post-war nation as a whole and will serve the ideals of democracy and equality. Now, we could go on with this. It's very important that Franklin Roosevelt in 1945 meets with Ibn Saud. And there's an exchange in Saudi Arabia of the legitimacy of the Saud family to rule Saudi Arabia in exchange for guarantee of access to oil on the part of the United States. There are a whole range of things that are going on at this time that anticipates the explosion of post-World War II, an economy as an economy of consumerism. My favorite magazine from my youth was Bride magazine. How many of you remember Bride magazine? All right. It was a Bride magazine's handbook for newlyweds, which was widely consulted in the 1950s. I carried this message, quote, "When you buy the dozens of things you never bought or even thought of before, you are helping to build greater security for the industries of this country. What you buy and how you buy it is very vital to your new life and to our whole American way of living." Now, lest you think this is dead and gone, I remind you that two presidents Bush, and it would have been the same for Democratic president. But two presidents Bush announced the following. The first was President Bush won at the Rio Earth Summit. He came for one day and announced at the Rio Earth Summit, quote, "The American way of life is not up for negotiation. Nothing must happen in making international treaties that will threaten American affluence. And if you want to understand the key to American foreign policy since World War II, you need understand one thing above all, the exacting requirements for American affluence." The second occasion was President George Bush, after 9/11, when he said exactly that in an address to the Congress and to the nation. "The American way of life is not up for negotiation." And when you talk about the American dream and the American way of life, you talk about many things, including that freedom that I talked about earlier, to an opportunity to pursue other pursuits beyond the compulsions to survival. But you also mean that you will not threaten a capacity to be a consumer as you wish. Democracy has largely come to mean the liberty to acquire and spend as you see fit and the conditions that are necessary to maintain that. All right, now, next, again, folks can jump in if you want to add more, challenge, rebut, etc. Otherwise, I get on a roll and I don't stop, so you gotta wave or speak up or something.
Well, you said capitalism is responsible. It's provided the money for research. I think it's been scientific invention in the Industrial Revolution where they found out how to make things easier and faster than they built.
Yeah.
Henry Ford, the mass production of Harvard.
Yeah.
That mass. And so capitalism brings in the finances to support capital investment in these huge processes.
Yeah.
So I think there's a component of science which is done a lot. And then
yes. Yeah, I just mentioned in passing yesterday that really the two most powerful developments for explaining modernity, meaning actually the last 500 years, but primarily from the Industrial Revolution onward, are the capitalism as a kind of economy and the rise of modern science and technology. That's a powerful combination. That's right.
Larry?
Yeah?
Wasn't the whole thing, too, about post-World War II, all the appliances that you were just reading was also part of the attempt to get women back into the house and out of the industry?
Oh.
To have more jobs for the men returning from the war.
So, maybe Rosie the Riveter needs to return, you know, to her real place. Okay, yeah.
Well, President Bush told us all to go out shopping.
I'm not one who listens to the radio a lot, but I happen to have it on. And in the car, and this was in Santa Fe. It wasn't immediately after 9/11, but the woman who was speaking, and she herself had called in, said that she felt that the best response for her to make in being a good citizen fighting the war on terrorism was to go shopping. That's what she said. I mean, it really is a strongly consumerist mentality. Okay, now I want to, just as grist for discussion and to move things along so we at least get into the economy of asceticism, list the criticisms of the economy of consumerism. You may have more, you may have other ones, but here's a start. The oldest criticism of capitalism is injustice. The point is, left to its own logic, and the magic of the marketplace, the globalizing economy tends to generate wealth at one pole and poverty at another pole in such a way that the truly basic needs are not met and inequalities are not leveled. Now, remember I said this is against the background of an enormously productive economy. So you still have masses who have been lifted from their misery. But the economy tends to solve the problem of production without solving the problem of distribution, which is the other big economic problem. And so this critique that it's unjust arose as soon as the Industrial Revolution began taking hold. And you have labor and management. We lived in Manhattan a long time. The Lower East Side is just a story of labor organizing efforts and protests against exploitive wages. And to this day, then, we have arguments over what kind of regulation of the market is proper. What kind of interventions? And the answers run all the way from Scandinavian-style capitalism to U.S. capitalism of the present persuasion. So that's the oldest, that's the first of the critiques, that it's unjust and needs some kind of intervening mechanisms. The second critique is the collective addiction or the iron cage criticism. This was given classic formulation in 1904 by Max Weber in The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. The Protestant ethic was an ethic of innerworldly asceticism, said Weber. That is, Protestants of the first generation worked hard, saved and reinvested, but deferred material gratification and didn't spend. They didn't max out their credit cards that they didn't have, but they didn't max out their credit cards and become rabid consumers living the high life. Now, this work hard, save, be entrepreneurial, and invest, but don't spend, was exactly what early capitalism needed to establish its infrastructure and for mass production. Yet, that kind of economy, capitalism, is profit and growth driven, and it requires a certain spirit and a certain ethic of its own. If people don't consume and sustain and increase that consumption, that economy languishes, or at its extreme points, dies. For the economic compulsion to consume, you need other values and other habits than those of early Protestants. You need, for example, persistent discontent coupled with insatiable appetites, so that wants become mass needs. Enter advertising. And I mentioned yesterday, more money is now spent on advertising than on public education from K through 12. The purpose of all advertising is the same. It's to make you discontent with what you have, so that you buy something you don't have, or an upgrade, like my Inspiron 8600 Dell laptop computer. Weber said that this happened, and it accomplished two things. It altered people's values, and it built an iron cage. If we don't spend and consume, jobs are lost, businesses go under, and in a globalized consumer economy, even access to the basics of life, food, shelter, clothing, work, are out of reach. We've built an iron cage around us. So Weber wrote in 1904 that we have become specialists without spirit and sensualists without heart in a disenchanted world in which victorious capitalism now rests on mechanical foundations. This economic compulsion, he goes on, detaches life from the highest spiritual and cultural values, and yet we imagine, quote, this nullity to be a level of civilization never before achieved. Wealth for innerworldly ascetics, and those are some of those earlier Protestants did get wealthy by doing the Protestant ethic. Wealth for those early ascetics was to lie on the shoulders like a light cloak, which can be thrown aside at any moment, he writes. But fate decreed that the cloak has become an iron cage. With the spirit of asceticism and its ethic gone from capitalism, we, like pushers and users, have become dependent upon an addictive way of life that we can't escape. Well, that's what it looked like in 1904. I don't know what it looks like now. Now, I'm going to, in the interest of time, skip over the third major criticism on the alienating and objectifying character of this capitalism and take that up in tomorrow's sessions on mystics and real estate. The last criticism is the most recent one, and it's ultimately the most important one. This rampaging global consumerist economy, which I said has only begun to take off because China, India, Korea, Malaysia, Russia, Eastern Europe, South Africa are joining the affluent nations. This economy is unsustainable. Over against that economy in which all human economies are rooted and upon which all human economies are utterly, totally dependent, namely the economy of Earth. One solitary factor allowed the industrial paradigm, whether it was industrial socialism or industrial capitalism, to bypass Earth's own economic requirements for its own regeneration and renewal on its own time scale in keeping with its own cycles. That one solitary factor is stored energy in the form of fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas. And while we have gained great efficiencies in the use of that exceptional factor, namely stored energy, overall, the cost to Earth of the globalizing economy from the Industrial Revolution to the present has been huge. And now I'm passing on science. On balance, and despite local good health in some places, all major life systems are in decline. We're losing topsoil far faster than it's being replaced. Water bodies, including the oceans and their life, are in decline. Fisheries are collapsing. Most of your fish in the future will be from fish farms because of the collapse of ocean fisheries. Arboreal and tropical forests, together with their biodiversity, is in decline, and we're in the sixth great extinction period. There have been five previous ones. Now we're in the sixth. This is the first one where extinction is caused by the loss of human habitat, which is a result of human transformation of the economy of Earth. And the quality and condition of the atmosphere is changing. Global warming is only the latest in a series of global warnings that modern economies are, from the point of view of Earth's utterly indispensable economy, unsustainable for both the biosphere and the atmosphere. Try getting along
without a healthy biosphere and a healthy atmosphere. Moreover, the values and the way of life cultivated by consumerism fail to yield the necessary perspective and sensibilities for changing our ways. And I asked Janet if I could get a copy of what was read Sunday noon from Wendell Berry. Ask farmer, poet. Ask questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. We don't have, as consumers, the kind of perspective that thinks about what Earth requires for its own regeneration and renewal on its own time scale. Incidentally, humus is the word, root word for human, topsoil, and humility, as well as humor. Okay, that's a partial listing of the standing criticisms of this most powerful human construct ever. Not even unprecedented military power begins to affect everyone's lives in the way triumphant global capitalism affects everyone's lives. For weal and for woe.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Just really quick up here. Do any of the criticisms in there, do they really take into consideration like property rights and things for like firms and private property rights in terms of renewal? And because I would think in a firm's best interest, like fisheries, for example, if they had those rights, they wouldn't exhaust the fisheries, but rather keep it going. And I just wonder if the criticisms take that into consideration.
And there's a great deal to be said for this. It's one of the arguments around not just property rights, but around privatization. If you own it, you're going to care for it. If it's the source of your profit, you're going to do what is required to sustain it. There's a strong argument for that. The argument on the other side is that firms, businesses, etc., competing with each other and pursuing the logic of capitalism will go to the places where they can pay lower wages and not face as many environmental protections, etc. So you get back and forth. And I think it's just one of the terribly important issues now of what the pros and the cons of that kind of privatization. Especially around basic needs. What about the privatization of water? Food stuffs and so on. Monsanto is terminal seeds now, so that farmers can't save the seeds from their own crops, but must buy another set of seeds and fertilizer. Ready Roundup if it's soybeans in order to continue that.
At the risk of being naive, do you think that our political leaders, including president and administration, know or feel or get information from scientists that tell them that we are in a decline?
The science community is not happy with this administration, by and large.
But I mean, I'm looking at motives here. Do they know that what scientists are saying, and then not passing it on or not talking about it?
I'm not going to judge the extent of that. I know from some experience in science and religion debates that, and you'll find this also in Thomas Friedman's book on The World is Flat, that in addition to rejecting what is scientific consensus on global warming, there's not political consensus about what to do about it, even among the scientists. There isn't any question that we've got a warming atmosphere, and that a portion of that warming has to do with the greenhouse effect. So if that's what you mean, there's that issue. What has made the Professional Scientific Organization, the National Science Foundation, AAAS, the Association for the Advancement, American Association for the Advancement of Science, lobbying so hard in Washington, is that the Bush administration cut the NSF budget for research by $100 million. And just at the time when the scientists will argue we need more research in science and engineering to counter the competition from China, India, South Korea, elsewhere.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to get into this, if you want to move on, but how do you think that the system of capitalism has contributed to our system of healthcare that we have today, where there's such a lack for most people of healthcare?
I'm going to really going to oversimplify here, and other people who are in healthcare and on the scene would need to add to this. But if you're a good business CEO and you take a business model approach, which you are as a responsible CEO to do, then you will ask what is unprofitable in the present way of doing things and what is profitable, and you'll seek to cut out as much as you can of the unprofitable in favor of the profitable. If you're in healthcare and you're responsible as physicians, you'll have a very different approach. It's those who are most sick and most unable to meet their own health needs that get the priority. And those who are then less sick and have more resources to address whatever illness, disease, etc. they face, that are the better, in better shape. And if you're in business, you will then neglect the poorest and the most vulnerable unless somebody else is paying the bill, because you as a business aren't going to be going that way. So there's an inherent tension there when healthcare becomes an industry, if it's the healthcare industry or the healthcare business. And it's another one of these huge sets of complex issues that become complex issues because of the kind of economy that we have. Another kind of economy may not solve it, I don't know, but the issues come out differently. Okay, I'm gonna push here a bit because our time is about out. And do we have a total here of the number of shoes that we have in order to stand on holy ground? What is the total number of square feet of shoes that we have? Well, let's just go by row. I'm not going to.
Okay, well, the first row has 350 shoes.
Oh.
Second row has 650
oh,
shoes.
Oh, what is with the second row?
Well, it's a longer row.
That's a longer row. Okay.
Well, I've got 990.
Wow, the back row. Those that die with the most shoes win. Okay.
That's almost 2,000 shoes in this room.
2,000 shoes per foot. What? I had balcony didn't.
We have 301.
Oh, okay. 2,000. 2,000. 2,301 shoes per square feet. It's an impressive number. Now just take the total in your lifetime and add to that. All right. That's a lot of shoes to take off to stand on holy ground. Okay, now, just, I'm sorry to push and to be quick about this. The economy of asceticism. The background here is, it's the short definition of asceticism is saying yes and saying no in a simple, disciplined way of life that focuses on spiritual richness and material simplicity. The background is this. Asceticism is not among those movements of reform that arose in response to the injustice and undermining of communities and alienation that came about in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. It's hoary with age, and it's a part of most religions that arose from the 5th century BCE, before Christ, and then onward into the later coming religions, namely Christianity and Islam. But it is from its inception a protest against consumerism as material attachment and material excess, and it's a protest against inequality. In Christianity, it arose early on as a protest against these traits in Greco-Roman culture. It was carried by as a lay movement that arose in the 4th century in Egypt and in Cappadocia, in present-day Turkey, which we now know as the monastic movement. But it's not only Roman Catholic, and it's not only Eastern and African Orthodox, and it's not only monastics. As I mentioned, early Protestants, especially in the Radical Reformation that broke with Luther and Calvin, were also ascetics, inner-worldly ascetics. In our place in the world, we will live out this frugal but spiritually responsible and rich way of life. So it's saying yes and saying no in a way of life marked by disciplines or practices of spiritual richness and material simplicity. There are enduring qualities across the various asceticisms, and I put some of these words up on the board just because they continue to show up in the literature about asceticism because they were so important in the forming of the movements. Askesis, these are all Greek. It's a notion of training. It's a training proper to these athletes of God, as ascetics are sometimes called. I call them Christian overachievers. You can call them athletes of God. It's a life of attention, focus, discipline, cultivated spiritual habits. Enkrateia is comprehensive self-control. That is a discipline of body, soul, heart, and mind. High on the list of avoided behaviors, for starters, in almost all traditions of asceticism, are excess and ostentation as lavish material consumption, always loose sex is way up in the high tie on the list, and violence towards humans and towards animals. You always have pictures of ascetics as living in harmony with the beasts. Sometimes they're quite fabulous, these stories, and not very believable. But it does indicate the disposition of nonviolence toward human beings and toward other creatures. But I said the focus is on disciplines that provide a comprehensive self-control. So for Asune, this is the positive side of self-control. It means moderation in all things, or it's the expression of self-control in the form of moderation in all things. And then in all ascetic traditions you have apatheia, which is the cultivation of detachment from distractions. This is the soul craft of a disciplined life centered in God. When G.K. Chesterton visited Times Square in 1922, he observed that what he called the colors and the fires, that all the colors and the fires were attached to an endless flow of commodities being advertised and hawked. He said, light and fire, basics of all life, have previously been linked to powerful sacred traditions and meanings. But now, says Chesterton, they were part of the new illumination of mass advertising, an illumination that has, quote, has made people weary of proclaiming great things by perpetually using it to proclaim small things. A life of taking built upon the carefully cultivated desire for essentially small things that thwart the true self, that's asceticism's protest. Asceticism says we must cultivate detachment from distractions so that the authentic self, the image of God itself, is not thwarted by small things. And the ascetic is always after the what ascetics call, Christian ascetics call, our natural humanity, our true self. But that requires detachment from distractions and attention to great things, the things that truly count. Okay, our time is really almost spent. We've got 5 to 10 minutes for discussion. I'll continue tomorrow with one remarkable expression of asceticism vis-a-vis the present global economy. I don't think I have time to go into that now. An address by Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew in Santa Barbara, California, a few years back, outlining the way in which asceticism speaks to the economy of consumerism. So we'll pick that up tomorrow. For now, and then we'll go on to mystics and real estate. But for now, I want to finish with an important point in this life of saying yes and saying no, a life of annunciations and renunciations, occasionally denunciations. The point is this. The no to a distracting, non-authentic way of life is always uttered on the basis of a yes that goes, and it's the yes of a centered life. The yes is foundational. The no is in response to the yes. Asceticism, then, is not, first of all, a protest. It's, first of all, a life centered in God. A life centered in God that frees what ascetics call our natural humanity, or our true self, that gets freed through sound discipline and spiritual exercises. So the no's are important, but they're rooted or grounded in the yes, which is all important. Francis, to pick an ascetic who loved the earth fiercely in a simple way of life, albeit he was an extreme Christian overachiever, he chooses voluntary poverty, even vagabondage, not in order to protest consumption. He chooses to go naked and unshod, naked in his dying days, because Such nakedness yields unmediated contact with the beauty of the world and God. And he wants to live fully in that beauty. He needs voluntarily to truly be poor in order to stand with the involuntarily poor and with the self-emptying God of the poor. So his poverty is his choice on the basis of his yes to the beauty and self-emptying God. His humanity as a child of God is at stake, as far as Francis is concerned. It's the yeses that lead to the noes. The noes are not the reason or the end of asceticism. They're the consequence of asceticism. I finish by saluting Holden, because Holden has always made a good faith effort to bring those who come here face to face with the challenges and the joys of the simple life in the midst of an addictive consumerist culture. And we usually never agree here about all the details, but it's the right struggle.
I got a question.
Yeah.
Take your last minute. So what's to be done? In other words, if you see people and they're set in their ways and our whole culture is that way, without shaking your finger and feeling justified in how bad the rich people are,
yeah,
which is very tempting.
Yeah.
Same deal. How do you, what's the first, and I think you hit it, this life. I can't see myself walking up to anybody and say, hey, how would you like a centered life? Be more centered in your life, pardon me.
Not a bad question. No. Well, let's stay for the moment with the tradition of asceticism.
Yeah, I don't want to make a discussion, but I thought...
No, I want to make a discussion, but I want to take off from that, because the answer to your question could come from any number of directions, all of them valid. But I just want to stay with asceticism. And tomorrow we'll talk about mysticism. These deep traditions that have been around for millennia keep recurring cross-culturally in every age and time and clime for a very basic reason. They speak to something profound in the human spirit. You will never have a time when you won't have some version or another of people who seek through a series of practices, disciplines, to live a life, simple life, centered in God. There's something that speaks to us in that. So, one answer, well, next point. There have always been communities that have sought to live that kind of life. The radical wing of the Reformation gave rise to a whole set of what are often called utopian Christian communities. There are a number of those still around, where on a community basis you seek to live this kind of life. In the present, and in the present phases of globalization, there has also been a backlash against a rampaging consumerist culture on the part of a lot of people who seek individually and in communities to offer some other way of living than this kind of frenzied, harried scramble. And so one answer to your question, what is to be done, is to look to the places of folks who are already doing it and see what they're up to. Now, that's not a small matter. I've been trying to collect some of these communities, especially focusing on social justice and environmental well-being. And I'm just amazed at the fact that they're all over the place. You don't hear about them because they're all so local for the most part, although the internet makes possible networking on a scale we've not seen before. But business isn't telling you, government isn't telling you, academe isn't telling you, and the mass media aren't telling you. Now, what are your major sources of information? There's just a lot happening here, there, and all over the place that we're not aware of precisely of, on the part of people who are trying to construct an alternative or a modification, and doing it in small and large ways. And I think we talked, Dorothy, about a forum this week on what is to be done or what are some people doing. And the last thing I want to say, and I won't keep you and me from bed, the last thing I want to say is that in the times of major transition, when societies were forced to move from one major set of systemic arrangements to another major set of systemic arrangements, or if not actually forced, did so anyway because something else was brewing that was more compelling. I'm thinking of the shift from feudalism to the rising bourgeoisie, which soon became capitalism, all right? Or I'm thinking of 1989 and the fall of state-established and failed socialism. A whole number of nations had to make major transitions. In the studies of how societies effectively negotiate a shift, a major arrangement, the ones that did it with the least pain and the most, the best kind of outcomes were those where they already had all sorts of little cell movements of and groups of people working on alternatives during the previous time. Instead of having no leadership, no ideas, no experiments, those were the societies that most successfully negotiated the differences. But we'll get to that. Any last comments or questions?
Yeah. One has to admire the Amish, the struggle they're going through is this culture all around us.
Yeah. Well, there's a wide spectrum, and they occupy a place on that. There are also urban communities doing this. Yeah.
We'll talk about it more on Thursday night, right?
Yeah.
Well, Larry, do you know about, I'm so much more familiar with aesthetic types in the Christian community than Muslim.
Yeah.
Is there some distinctive branch?
Yeah, I don't know much about where those communities are or what particular form those traditions have taken.
I think it's interesting, the environmental community doesn't look at the church at all.
That's changing somewhat, but that's been the case. Karl Pope, after he was president,
right.
He was the president of the Sierra Club at the time. The Big Ten environmental groups haven't paid much attention at all to religious communities. After this address by Bartholomew that I'm going to share tomorrow, Karl Pope said, we've made a huge mistake in not turning to the religious communities and the environmental movement. We won't make the changes that have to be made if we don't have something on the order of religious tenacity and devotion and a set of long-term values.
David Brower said that the common characteristic between the environmental movements and the church was lack of humor.
But one must also realize that the portrayal of Christianity is not one which picks up the activities that are taking place in the strong religious environmentalism.
I don't think it's interesting that all of us expended huge amounts of stored carbon, to get here.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to close my laptop now and go home.